Hey everybody, I'm Jim, I'm your speaker captain and alcoholic. Tonight I get the privilege of introducing Emily H., currently living in Idaho, USA. She formerly a resident of California and a resident of Florida. She comes to us tonight from, a small town in Idaho, about 2 hours north of Nampa, I believe. She's a sponsor, she's a sponsee, and she loves horses. So if we could give it up for Emily H. from Idaho tonight, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. It's been a long time since I've done this, so you'll have to bear with me. I got sober on November 28, 1988. I only say that because each day is for the grace of God. I realized early on in my life I was probably had a addiction problem, only because when you handed me one graham cracker, I had to have two. I was 13 when my brothers got me stoned for the first time, and I didn't take my first drink until I was 14 years old. I got drunk on Boone's Farm wine, and that was not fun. Then for a lot of years, I just pretended I didn't have any problem, and my addiction turned off into many different directions. I learned in the program when I was growing up from my sponsor that no matter what, I was probably always had an addictive personality. And, of course, I didn't believe him. But I have what I call my $30,000 big books. I went through a program when I was 27, a 30-day program. And my first husband told me I was well, so I believed him. And I didn't go back to meetings at all. So from there, I decided, oh, I can just drink coffee Keokis in the morning. Now, mind you, I had two small kids. I was never thoroughly drunk in front of my children, thank God. But it went from coffee and Kahlua to Kahlua and brandy. And then I realized that I had a serious problem. So I told him that he would have to take the kids, which is a very big regret. I felt guilty for many years. Because my drinking started to turn into just drinking straight Corona in the morning. And I didn't want to hurt my children. I didn't ever want my children to see me drunk. So I left and I went on a run. You know, I came from the streets. I'm not one of those alcoholics that had everything intact when they came in. It was hard. I got sober in California and drinking in California and doing all the other things that I did in California. I should have landed myself in jail. Luckily, I didn't. You know, I got pulled over twice on the 22nd of March in the same year. I got pulled over twice, one for running a red light and one for doing something else. I had no idea what it was for. And I had to chuckle because once I got sober, I found out that was the day I married my first husband. And, you know, it was hard. And when I came into the program, I was one of those that wasn't sure I had a problem. There was a lot of Alano centers up there. There was one up the street. So I would walk up, you know, I'd sit on this little coffee box. I'd sit outside the meeting. I would sit on the little coffee box and just sit there and listen. And this round table had all the old timers in it. It wasn't a big meeting, but it had seven of the oldest timers you ever heard of. I was 30 days sober. And I got up off that box and I said, I am done. I was going to walk up to the bar up the street. I said, I'm finished. Well, oddly enough, God had a different plan. There was a kid that I went to high school with that I hadn't seen in years work in the coffee bar. And he told me, don't leave before the miracle happens. And I'm like, the hell are you talking about? You've got to be stupid. What miracle? I walked out the door. He walked out after me. And he said, don't you think you can just sit on that box just a little while longer? So I sat on that box just a little while longer. And I sat on that box probably, oh, I'd say till I was about 4 months sober. And I finally decided that maybe I might want to sit at that table. And in between that, I was having some medical issues. And it wasn't behind alcohol and drugs. So, went to the doctor's office and found out that I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, which is a very hard thing to detect in early stages. And I said, I didn't get sober to die. And they went in. I was 28 years old. And they went in and did surgery. And it came out. And I thought I'd gone back out. So evidently, I was not a nice person coming out of anesthetic because I started throwing bedpans and everything else. One more time, God intervened in my life. Because they had a nurse who was a traveling nurse that I found out a long time later. She happened to be in the program and told me I didn't go back out. It was a hard concept for me to try to stay sober because, you know, I blamed my childhood. I blamed everything around me. And drinking was my only escape to not live in my own head. You know, living on the street, doing what I did to stay drunk, to make money, is a hard thing to swallow. Even after all this time in my life, I look back. I just now started another four-step at 32 years because I don't care how much time you have. The more sober you are, the more things, unfortunately, for some reason, pop up. You know, and doing a thorough moral inventory of myself is something I have to do and keep myself in check just so I can stay sober one more day. You know, living life in sobriety is a gift. You have to just take it. Sometimes it's 1 minute at a time. Sometimes it's 1 second at a time. But it is a gift of a new life. I know a few people that have a trouble with their concept of God. Well, in Bill's story, in my big book, which is ancient, it's on page 12. One alcoholic's talking to another one. He says, I don't believe in God. How can I do this? And it says, choose your own perception of God. Well, bless my sponsor's heart. He knew I had a real good problem with God, so he handed me a glass doorknob. And he said, this is your God. Now pray to him. And I looked down and I said, you've got to be kidding. You're handing me a doorknob. He told me when I need to pray in the morning, he says, I want your shoes under your bed. And you get on your knees. And you get under your bed. And while you're down there, why don't you say a few prayers? When I was 2 years sober, I didn't have a desire to drink. I didn't want to go to meetings anymore. I was taking my kids to school. I was picking them up. And I was locking myself away in the house. And looking back, that was probably where it was going to come down to, I was going to drink again. So my second husband went down and he got this little old short Jew. His name was Marvin. comes up to the house, tells me to throw my hair in a ponytail because my hair was really long. He says, come with me. So for the next 5.5 years, I was raised with everybody around me in program. My sponsor was absolutely fantastic, but I managed the lot. I ran the coffee bar. I ran the Alano Center. I started sponsoring girls. I became president of the board of directors, but it saved my life. Coming from where I came from with nothing, I mean literally nothing, I had alienated everyone in my family. I have lied, cheat, steal, stole. I mean, I did it all. I didn't deserve anybody to love me. I didn't deserve it. So I thought. And I had an old-timer. I was behind the coffee bar one day, and he says, you know what? He said, if you don't learn to love yourself, no one else can love you. Well, you know, that's hard to swallow. Really hard to swallow. How do you learn to love yourself when you actually hate yourself and everything you ever did? So my sponsor says, well, write a 4-step. Now, to be honest, I was 3.5 years sober, and it took me until I was 5.5 years sober to finish that 4-step. Because I just could not see my part in some of this stuff that I had no control over when I was young. You know, there's that 3rd step prayer, you know, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy will. You know, I live by that today. I live by that today. Because the only way I can stay sober is to share, whether I make sense or not, guys, I'm sorry, by sharing, by working with others. I take care of people. You know, I've got an 89-year-old mom at home that I take care of. Now I got Megan. You know, I do what the next indicated thing. Now, I know in the program it says, you know, women sponsor women, men sponsor men. I ended up with 2 old codgers to sponsor me. I had 2 sponsors in my younger years, but in my younger years coming into the program, I had a hard time with women. And I was told that I eat them up and I spit them out. And I was like, well, that's not nice. But, you know, these 2 men saved my life. You know, they had 30 and 40 years when I came in, and they saved my life. I had an old codger tell me one time that he didn't see me making it to 5 years of sobriety because when you're 5 years sober, you come stark raving emotionally sober. I said, oh, you're so full of shit. Well, I held on to that resentment. Well, that resentment got me to 6 years. But at 5 years, I decided I was going to quit both jobs and just strictly take care of my kids because my ex-husband just wasn't paying too much attention. Well, I'll tell you, that was stark raving emotionally sober. And I had an Al-Anon friend, and I called her. I said, I can't do this anymore. And she goes, well, then just go drink. And she hung up the phone. I was like, well, what kind of an answer was that? And she was right. If I can't do what I was doing, then go back out and drink. I didn't choose to do that. I chose to go back to work nights at the Alano Center. I chose to start working a program different than what I was doing because there was a point that came that I started to try to work it my way. My way doesn't work for nothing. I start doing things my way, I create chaos around me. So I went back working. I did another 4-step and realized that I still had a lot of guilt, a lot of anger, and a lot of resentment. And I didn't know how to get rid of it. So when I gave my 4-step to my sponsor, he said, how are you going to manage getting rid of all that anger and resentment? I go, I don't know. He goes, are your shoes under your bed? And I said, well, yes. He goes, well, there's your first start. pull the shoes out, but don't forget to pray when you get down there. So when I was probably, well, it was 1997, I got a really good job offer in Florida. But I didn't want to leave California without my kids. So I took my ex-husband back to court to get sole custody. But they were old enough at that point the judge was going to let them decide. And so, of course, they wanted to stay with their friends. I wasn't out there 6 months, and I had the oldest. Then came the youngest. And I realized that my children were getting stoned. And I was like, oh, God, here we go. So I had the bandit in my house. I said, you know, this isn't, you know, your mom's sober. This is not appropriate, and one of you's got an addictive personality, and it's not going to work. So either you can stop what you're doing, or you can go back to California. It's your choice. You know, the program for me was never easy. It always made it difficult. I have a big book that looks needs to be rebound because I read it constantly. It still has all the stickers and all the highlights in it. You know, from when I first got sober. Going back to my past, in high school, I don't think I ever had a sober breath through high school. How I graduated with a 4.0 grade average, I have no idea. There was a McDonald's around the corner, and there was always Bacardi and Coke in my glass. In every class I went to. Every class, I was constantly drunk. And it was eye-opening in the fact that I never ended up in jail drinking. I ended up in jail in sobriety. Because those two tickets I told you about that I got on the same day, I had a warrant out for my arrest on one of them. I went to the jail to take care of my warrant, and they promptly put me in jail for my second warrant. And I mean, I was dressed to the nines. I was not planning on going to jail. And I was like, wow. So God wanted to show me, even in sobriety, I think I was 64 days in sobriety. And I was like, this is where I'm ending up. I'm now got sober and I'm going to jail. My sponsor eventually bailed me out, but I was in there for a nice hot minute. I mean, they took me all the way to the cell. And I think it was God's way of showing me, this is where you're going to go. If you can't get your butt in gear, start working a program and get yourself straight. And that was the hard thing for me. I dove into my big book like it was a Bible. And I tried to learn as much as I could from the big book. My sponsor took me to Sermon on the Mount meetings. He took me to so many different meetings. And by the time I was 6 years sober, he had me on the speaking circuit. And we used to go to conventions, the conventions that they had. And I mean, it really, for me, Alcoholics Anonymous not just saved my life, but it saved my soul. I had no soul. I didn't care about anybody. And so, you know, if there's anybody that's really struggling at this point, put your shoes under your bed. So you make sure you hit your knees and thank God just for that one moment. You know, and if you're really in doubt, read the third step prayer. You know, today, my life is different. You know, my daughter came home. She was drunk. I did the total Al-Anon thing. I rescued her. I brought her home. I was not equipped to have another alcoholic in the house that was, you know, not clean. She was trying to be. And I made so many mistakes with her to the point that one night she asked me for the car. And she was being arrogant and said, I'm not like everybody else that you put me in that program in. I still have my driver's license. Well, subsequently, she took her grandmother's car. She landed someplace she had no idea where she was, and she ran into a fence and totaled the car. And I realized at that time that I wasn't working a program, my program. I was working the codependent program. Alcoholism is a disease that people don't understand. I am thoroughly believed that if I had not gotten sober when I did, I would have been dead. You know, I got sober at a really young age. I was 28 years old. But from the time I was 14 to the time I was 28, I don't think I ever drew a sober breath. Ever drew a sober breath. You know, I would come home drunk. My mom would look at me and she would shake her head. I don't know. I never asked her. I don't know if she knew I was drunk or didn't know I was drunk. But I never drew a sober breath. And the one day I decided I was going to quit drinking, I think I was 26, I started shaking. And just, my skin felt like it was going to crawl. I was just crawling. And I said, the only thing that's going to stop this is if I take another drink. And like I said, when I was 27, I went into a hospital program for 30 days. Came out. My husband thought I was well. Oh, my alcoholic head was still going around because he wouldn't let me go to meetings. He wouldn't let me out of the house. I was a prisoner. Wouldn't let me make phone calls, so I couldn't call somebody to talk to help me. So I drank again. It was inevitable. I drank again. And it was at that time that I told him I had to go. I can't stop. I've got to go. You don't understand. You told me I was well. I'm not. And for another year, I drank. And I drank. I mean, I literally lived on the streets. I lived under a bridge. You know, I lived everywhere. Anywhere I knew was safe or that where the homeless people would live. And it takes back memories. You know, it was hard. It was hard because I knew I had babies at home. And I knew I wanted to be mom. And I couldn't. I was incapable of being a mother. So I checked myself into the next hospital program. And I said, somebody save me. And it worked. All I had to say was, somebody save me. And God did. God saved me. And then when they got to the point where everybody started talking about God, I went, oh, Lord, I'm in the wrong spot. How can I do this? And that's when my sponsor says, and it's still written in my book on a sticky note, page 12, Dr. Bob's story, choose your own perception of God. And when I came out of there, I moved home with my mom. And God bless her, because she didn't have to take me back, because she's one of the I wreaked havoc in her life. And she did. And, you know, I started going to meetings. I started doing what I had to do to make sure that I could someday be that mom I wanted to be. In the midst of all this, I ended up having to have a hysterectomy because I had cancer, going through chemotherapy. And for the grace of God, you know what? I never thought about drinking during that whole thing. I was on poor me. Why do I have to do this? I got sober after everything I've done, living under a bridge, wreaking havoc in everybody's life. Why me? And my sponsor looked at me and said, why not you? How rude can you be? And he goes, it's not rude. This adds to your story of how you stayed sober. I was like, no, all right, fine. So I was, it was so bad that I couldn't go to meetings. So people from the club up the street would come and pick me up, take me to a big book study, lay me on the couch in the little house in the back, and then take me home. Because I couldn't walk. And I thought, you know, why are they doing this for me? It's because one more time, they're helping another alcoholic. And that's what it takes, is to help another alcoholic. When I got my 6-month chip, they had an alkathon which ran for 24 hours. And I was sitting on the back on the couch, and this gentleman, he'd been in a motorcycle accident when he was drunk, but he gave me his 6-month chip because it wasn't a chip meeting. Personally, for me as an alcoholic, I wreaked havoc in everybody's life. Anybody that came across me as an alcoholic, I was going to lie, I was going to cheat, I was going to steal from you. I was going to do what it took for me to get that next drink. You know, today, for me, my experience of living on the street, panhandling, you know, everything that alcoholics of my type do, was a learning curve. So today when I look at somebody that says, you know, can you give me a dollar? I'll buy you a meal, but I'm not going to pay for your alcohol. You know, it's hard sometimes when you look back at, for me, when I look back at my past and realize that I could have died so many times. I had a seizure behind alcohol. The places that I lived in were, that I chose to live in were horrible. I could have been killed. You know, there's just no doubt. I mean, I lived under a bridge with homeless people. I mean, you know, I wasn't, you know, when I went into the program, that last hospital program I checked myself into, they asked me if I had any clothes, and I said, no, this is what I've got. I was filthy. My hair was matted. I was just filthy. And they gave me a shower. They found me some clothes. They wanted to cut my hair. I had issues with that because it was down to my ankles. So we had to figure out how to brush the knots out. Eventually, I ended up having to cut my hair to my shoulders. You know, staying sober today for me is a gift. I do not take anything in my life for granted. You know, I don't take having a roof over my head. I lost my job during COVID. It's been tough trying to find another one. But I have a roof over my head. I have a little tiny bit side business I do for a friend of mine. I don't take anything at all for granted. And before I got sober, you know, I thought everybody owed me. My family owed me because they left. Everybody left when I was 9. My mom owed me because she moved from state to state. I would blame, you know, they turned me into an alcoholic. How did they think I was going to deal with all these feelings that I had? You know, I was actually raped when I was 17 years old. I was gang raped at 17 years old. And I stayed drunk after that. Thoroughly drunk. Passed out, blacked out, drunk. for at least 10 days. 10 days. And I had literally gotten drunk in my mom's garage, and she didn't know I was there, so I could feel safe. And when I came to, I had no idea where I was. And I was like, oh, my God, where am I? You know, my rock bottom was probably as far down rock bottom as you could ever, ever get. But yet that was the only way I was going to get here. I sat in meetings and listened to people come in and say, oh, they still had their Lamborghinis and they still had this, they still had that. And I said, well, then what the hell are you, how'd you turn into being an alcoholic if you still have all this stuff? Well, not everybody has to lose everything and live under a bridge. So for me today, it is a gift. It's a gift that I'm here with all of you to be able to speak, whether it makes any sense to you or not. If I'm all over the page, I apologize. It's been a long time since I've done this. But it is a gift. You know, God granted me another gift today. I got Megan. Picked her up from the bus station today. You know, my sister's going through cancer, and she's going through a lot of things, and she just couldn't take Megan. And she was asked to leave the place she was at. And I said, well, stick her on a bus and send her to me. You know, so my sister said to me, are you going to rescue her? I said, I don't rescue. I teach. And I said, you have to understand, I can't sponsor her because I'm her aunt. I don't believe in family sponsoring family. But, you know, I am grateful. I am grateful for the Zoom meetings and especially this group. This was the first time I'd ever been on a Zoom meeting, and Megan got me here. But it's for the grace of God. God knew what I needed. I just didn't know it. Sometimes, you know, I feel that God puts things in our paths. We don't even know we want them. And sometimes we balk at it and we leave and we don't do what was freely given to us until sometimes it's just too late. So if you're new in the program for me, don't leave before the miracle happens. Don't listen to your head. Pick up the phone. Call somebody. If you don't believe in God, that's okay. Find your own perception of God. It can be a doorknob. It can be Yoda. It can be whatever you choose until you can find a power greater than yourself. You know, and if you feel lost, pick up that big book. You know, there's stories in there that will talk to you and speak to you and, you know, understand. Israel has my phone number. Anybody ever needs anything, all you have to do is call me. Because I might be speaking, but you're all saving my life today. I get one more day of sobriety, one more day of feeling that I had a purpose in this life, and I can try and make a difference in this life. If it's just for a moment. I don't ever want to see anybody in here that doesn't have much time, that they're still struggling to end up doing what I did and go back out and end up under a bridge. It's no fun out there. You know, it isn't. It's no fun out there. You know, it's hard. You know, and my first 3 years were hard. But we all have a network. We've all got this program. We all have this Zoom meeting. We all have friends to connect to. We don't have to consume ourselves in our own heads. Because I always have a saying, you don't want to go in my head. Never want to go in my head alone because there's so many broken bottles up there. Or I might cut my feet. You know, this program is a gift. It's 1 minute at a time, 1 second at a time. But it is a privilege to be able to be a part of something so wonderful. You know, that, you know, Bill and Bob created a great tool for alcoholics. Well, you've got those ones in L.A. that say, oh, you'll never drink again, but they don't use a program. Never understood how you stay sober without working a program. You know, I personally hope for all of you that every day is a blessing, even when it's hard to stay sober that day, that you don't take that drink. You give it your best shot. Get on your knees. Get those shoes out from underneath the bed, but get on your knees and ask God, just give me today. And then I said, if you have a hard time with God, find a glass doorknob. But I want to thank you all for being here, all for listening to me. I know I sound a little bit nutty and kind of all over the place. I usually used to pray before this, but I didn't have a hot minute to do that. So, but I want to thank you all for listening, and you all have a blessed evening. Thank you.